Hey everyone, we are back for another episode of the Rum and Stoke podcast, and we're joined this week by Red Bull media host, Olympic commentator, and host of the infamous Famous First Words, it's Tim Warwood. We're going to get straight into the episode because we know Tim's got so many stories, we're going to try cram all of them in, but hopefully you're going to enjoy it. Let's get on with it.
Just a heads up, the rums are flowing quite heavily in this episode, and there might be some explicit language.
Someone who talks from it for a living, I'm not very good at explaining myself. Okay, so hello, I am Tim Warwood. I am a snowboarder from Birmingham in the UK, turned TV presenter slash commentator slash mouth for hire. Not like that. Not like that.
Yeah, I think that's pretty spot on. Mouth hires.
I sometimes, depending on who I'm trying to impress, I sometimes drop ex-professional snowboarder. But considering this is a snowboard podcast, there's no point in putting it in there. Is there? People know already.
That was our next question: is were you ever actually a pro? Because Google has you down as an actor and a writer.
Honestly, no. Google just throws you into IMDb. That's what it does.
Google has me down as earning £1.3 million a year, which is, I find, quite incredible, to be honest. I earn nowhere near that. I don't even earn the 0.3. I don't even earn the 0.1. It's weird, isn't it, Google? See, I've put my date of birth in wrong. So if you go to, there's a website, and I only know this because I Google myself once a week. I don't really Google myself once a week. There's a website called Famous First.
You know that's not getting cut, right?
No, I know, yeah. No, you'll cut it just after I say I don't Google myself. Yeah, there's a website called Famous Birthdays, and if you go on it, it's got mine on.
I've been on it.
Yeah,
I've been on it.
As 47.
I was on it today.
It's going down as 47 because I must have put my date of birth in on a website because I was like, I don't want to put my real date of birth in here. But it's got my date of birth and it puts me down at 47. So I'm a 47-year-old actor that earns £1.3 million a year. I mean, it's just, God.
Doesn't sound too bad. Sounds like quite a good career.
Right. Yeah, I'm doing all right. So yeah, are you happy with that intro?
I'm happy with that intro.
All right. I'm happy with it. I mean,
I think mouth for hire is the prime part.
It's funny. I was chatting to my wife this morning and we were driving back from the school run. And I was saying, obviously work's tough for everybody at the moment, especially for kind of our industry and all that kind of stuff. And I said, I could do with kind of getting a bit of a CV together and putting something down, just kind of what I've done and what I can do and listing all your bits. I mean, I've not written a CV since I applied for a job at the Snowdome, I think, but I think mouth for hire is quite apt because, you know, just give me something to talk about and a microphone and I'll do it. It doesn't really matter what it is. And actually, when you start to think of all the stuff I've done, it's quite apparent that I could just kind of chat about anything really, which is good and bad, I suppose. But yeah, it's been quite a varied career, so to speak. So I think the whole just being a mouth for hire encompasses all of that in one go.
I guess, speaking of your career, if we go back to like the days of the lockdown projects,
yeah,
like what was that like producing a snowboard movie back in the day? Because I'm guessing it wasn't the helicopters and everyone's got a GoPro sort of thing. It is nowadays.
Yeah, it was very rudimental and very first and foremost. I did a lot of seasons in Vail in Colorado, and on the kind of my second or third season, we made a snowboard movie called The Invasion. Well, actually, the one before that we made was called 220, and that was named after the room that we all used to hang out in, and it was my friend John Eldridge and Tom Eldridge. They're two Cornish brothers, and they had a video camera and they would do a lot of filming. So we'd all hang out, we'd all snowboard together and shoot and film and edit. And we actually edited it on a VHS player, you know, the whole stop start edit section and just really basic, but made this video and it was really cool and we loved it and we had a little premiere there. And then next year, Tom Eldridge got a Mac, one of the very first Mac laptops, and it came with one of the first incarnations of iMovie. So he had the ability to cut and edit digitally and it just blew our minds, you know, and the stuff and the possibilities. And he's like, we should make a snowboard movie. And I went, yeah, I said, and being the big loud mouth that I was back in the day, I knew quite a few people and I used to work at a snowboard shop called Boardwise. So I knew a lot of the reps and I knew a lot of the sales agents and stuff like that. So I would, I said to them, look, this is how we'll do it. You film an edit and club it all together and I'll drum up a bit of cash and we'll get a load of these printed and we'll maybe sell some or get a distributor or do something. So we did that. We made this snowboard movie and Tom actually ended up going up to Whistler to hang out with Gendel and Scott McMorris and Elliot Neave and all the Whistler boys and filmed them. And then we made this British snowboard movie called The Invasion and it went down really well. It was basic and it, you know, the riding wasn't great. In fact, it was pretty shit, but it was just what it was. It was kids living in the mountains, just having a laugh. And I think a lot of people saw it. We had a premiere for it in Tamworth at the local cinema. And, you know, the whole scene descended upon Tamworth on a cold, frosty November night for this premiere. And it just was amazing. And everyone was like, well, you're going to do another one. You're going to do another one. So we were like, yeah, let's do it. So we went and did the sequel. And loads more British riders got involved. And at this point, video cameras were becoming more prevalent. So everyone was buying, not everyone, but a few people were buying video cameras. Yeah, crews out in France that were filming. And, you know, again, the next summer, we all got together down in Cornwall where John and Tom lived. And we created, a second video called The Sequel. And, it went down really well again. And so that was kind of the first incarnations of British kind of serious snowboard movies, British snowboard movies. And then the year after, me and Gendel got together and decided to make, Gendel had been filming lots. Gendel at this point had got a video camera. So he was doing lots of filming and I had a video camera and I was in Vail doing lots of filming. And so we decided, me and Gendel were like, look, we'll do it together. We'll make one. And we came up with Lockdown Projects, a little production company, me and Gendel. And we took all the submissions in and got a load of sponsors. And actually one of the biggest things that made it happen was Jeremy Sladen. He's kind of saw the value in it. He's like, well, look, why you're going to try and sell this, maybe sell 300 of them if you're lucky, or if, I think it's probably 100. He's like, why don't I pay you to do it? And it becomes the Snowboard Asylum's movie. The whole movie's presented by the Snowboard Asylum. I'll do everything. You just give me a movie at the end. So we were like, okay, this sounds really good. So spent all season filming. And in that summer, me and Gendel got paid by the Snowboard Asylum as if we were shop workers. And we were sitting in our bedrooms editing the first Lockdown Projects movie.
Jeremy Sladen is one of the managers for the Snowboard Asylum, right?
Well, Jeremy Sladen is Mr. Snowboard Asylum. So he is the Snowboard Asylum. So it's his gig. He's the boss. And yeah, he paid us to make this movie. He then went and got a load of sponsors. So he said to all the companies, like, chuck us some cash. We'll put you a logo on this. And then he went and then pressed 5,000 DVDs. This is when DVDs first came out. And it was like, we're like sick. So we made 5,000 DVDs and he gave them away. Anybody that bought a snowboard in the snowboard time would get this free DVD. So it was a way of reaching kind of loads of people, loads of new. And it was, you know, they were goofy films. I mean, we didn't hold back. We had S Club fucking 7 on them. Do you know what I mean? Like, these soundtracks were ridiculous. Yeah, 7 and Blondie and all kinds of music, but it was just accessible snowboarding. We loved the slams and the tries as much as we loved the backside rodeos and the 540s and all, you know, the latest and greatest tricks at the time, you know. So it was snowboarding, it was British snowboarding, and it was just the, you know, when we went up on the hill, we weren't going to try rodeos. We were just going out to have a laugh and to show off to your mates and have a bit of fun. And we managed to translate that to the movies and they went down really well. And we were really lucky that Jeremy supported the movies, and we did four. So we did four winters, four summers, making these snowboard movies and creating these movies. But the movies themselves got less and less about the snowboarding and more about the filmmaking and me and Gendler's frustrated filmmakers and directors just trying to make comedy skits. And
what year was that one?
Okay, so proper, well, our first one was 2004. Yeah, 2004. So then it was 2005, 2006. So it's 2007 was Terminal Ferocity.
Because I always used to watch those. I'd watch, because you did them as you had the optional commentary on them, or the kind of the behind the scenes as an option, didn't you?
Yeah.
I remember the first few times I just watched the proper film, I was like, I don't want to see the behind the scenes. Like, it's just going to be people talking. And then 6 times later, watched the behind the scenes, I was like, actually, that makes the movie. Like, the behind the scenes is amazing.
Well, it's funny. We made Terminal Ferocity, that was the mockumentary. We made it as a mockumentary. And what would happen is in between the snowboarding bits was us trying to film the snowboard bits. And it was, you know, heavily influenced by The Office and Friends Like Us and all these kind of fly on the wall documentaries at the time. And we were really heavily influenced by all that stuff that that's how we made the movie. And then it was actually the other way around. So in the DVD extras, we just cut out all those bits and had the snowboard movie. So if you went into the extras, you could watch Terminal Ferocity cut together as a snowboard movie. But actually, the actual DVD was this mockumentary. So, so at that point, we were like, yeah, maybe we need to move on a bit now. Maybe we need to move on to let someone else take the reins. But we had, like six, seven years of making snowboard movies, and brilliant. But you're absolutely right. It was way before GoPro. It was way before drones. Cameras were massive. My camera had a battery in my back with the cable coming to the camera. You know what I mean? Like, that's how insane it was. There was no such things. There were head cams. I remember I got a head cam, but it was like a roll of six double D batteries strapped to the side of your head. You know, almost like a toilet roll on the side of your head, again, with a cable that went into a camera in your backpack. And the quality was so shit. It was so bad and all this stuff. So it was just, but I think, you know, there was certainly a sense of when you did get a good shot back then, you know, if it was a backcountry shot, it was so much harder to get those shots that I think they were quite appreciated, because people were watching, like, bloody hell, how did they get that shot? Yeah. This amazing. Now, if it's a backcountry shot,
I get that.
It's rubbish unless the drone flies through the guy's legs while he's doing a switch or 12. You're not impressed. You know.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, these days, unless the camera work is something that's revolutionary, then it's most of the time just going to go a little bit unnoticed. And with the amount of tech that everyone's got in their pockets, it's getting so much easier to do the stuff which years ago would have taken a full team.
Also, this is talking days before the internet, you know, days before YouTube, days before, if you did want to put something online, you'd have to leave it overnight, and certainly halfway through the next day, it would still be uploading. And you'd be screwed if someone picked up your phone during the middle of it or something. You know, it was like that thing. So the other amazing thing with our premieres and the way it worked was that you couldn't see the footage. There was no Instagram. You couldn't upload the clips. I mean, I sound like such an old fuddy-duddy now saying this, but you couldn't share the clips. So we had, you know, we got a little office in Brighton the third year, and me and Gen were in our office, and we'd schedule in days for everyone to come down and stay with us. Me and Gen were living in a house in Brighton, and we'd have Danny Wheeler come down, or Mike Austin, and they'd bring a load of tapes, and you'd sit there together and you'd watch their season, because you didn't have Instagram. I didn't know what they were doing. You'd hear rumors on the grapevine. You know, there'd be a couple of big contests where everyone would get together, or someone would come traveling through, and they'd be like, bloody hell, have you heard what Scott McMorris has been doing up in Whistler? He's been doing this cab nines, cab tens, da da da. And then, so you'd be frothing to see this footage, and everyone would be like buzzing. And so the premieres were so much more special, because it was very much here's what the UK snowboard scene did last winter. This is what they did. And everybody would sit down and they'd drink it in. And that, you know, I remember Nelson Pratt. The rumors flying around about Nelson doing the he did the off the court, off the heels corked seven.
I don't know who that is. I'm really sorry.
No, no,
I don't
Nelson, know who Nelson that is. Pratt is an old snowboarder who's not with us anymore. But he was widely regarded as one of the most humble and best snowboarders at the time, and he was light years ahead. And he was the kind of snowboarder that would go, do you know what? I'm going to try one of those rodeos, or I'm going to try one of them switch backside fives. And you'd be like, you sure? He's like, yeah, I've seen it in a magazine, or yeah, I think I can give it a go. And he'd do it first or second go perfectly. And this clip, this rumor went round of Nelson in teen doing this amazing off the heels backside seven in the backcountry. And when me and Gendel got the footage for proper, we were like, holy crap. And when we showed that, the first time, people just fraught. They just went lost their shit in the cinema. It was like, ah. So, yeah.
What year was that?
Oh, so this was 2004. Yeah.
Because like off backside off the heel sevens are still pretty nice to see nowadays. And like that's...
That's literally like 15 years later, and there's still like it's still a fresh trick to watch. Like,
yeah, and it was a golden time. It was a golden time to be surprised by it. You know, it's nice now when a clip pops up on Instagram, and you know the rumors fly around. Someone sends it you, or someone tags you in it, and you're like, holy crap, that's pretty rad. And it's Mark McMorris and Prime Park or whatever it might be, but. Now back then was nice. It was nice to get the footage and to be able to showcase it to everybody, you know, on that big premiere. It was nice.
And do you still get that kind of that excitement nowadays of like seeing a new trick? Because I know one of the Swiss riders did switchback alley-oop double 10 in the pipe. And like, because that's quite a new one that we've kind of seen in this era. Like, do you still get that kind of buzz from seeing something?
Yes, do you know what? Yeah, I do. And it depends who I'm with. I'm really good at frothing and geeking out about snowboarding when I'm with the right people. I think you lose the stoke a little bit, you know, when I'm wiping Sonny's poo from underneath my fingernails. I'm not perhaps thinking about it so much, but definitely, you know, I'm happy to geek out quite a lot. I still get amazed at how the boundaries are getting pushed, for sure. And I think it's just...
I mean, you've got to be really...
Like pipe riding. Pipe riding blows my mind more than slope style, for sure.
Really?
Yeah. I think we're getting to that age of pipe now where... Because they've kind of hit the peak of physics in terms of like the 14s and whatever we see in the pipe, they're now having to go completely different with the alley-oops and the change of axis. I think is just going to, it's really going to see the creativity in pipe kind of explode out a little bit more.
Yeah.
Do you not think though that the potential for creativity in a slope style course is even higher due to the fact that most of them nowadays in the big events anyway, have quarter pipes in them and bowl features and everything else that just increases the options that the riders have?
I don't know. I think
slopestyle rails has got a bit spin to winny recently. Like from what we've seen, it's a lot of people are just, or have I missed the point entirely?
No. Actually, with that, you've 100% nailed it.
Yeah. I'm really sorry. My computer's about to die. Just plugging it in.
That's because I was bigging up slope style, wasn't it?
There we go.
Because you started talking skiing, and Tim was like, "Nah, I'm done for a Friday."
I think like it's hard, isn't it? Snowboard and freestyle skiing, and it is like when you've got anything judged the way it is, and when it has to be judged the way it is, because the riding is so insane and the level is so ridiculous. That it breeds a certain style. It's like, for instance, did you see? This is going to sound. I mean, this is the worst analogy I've ever used. Did you see George Russell, Formula One youngster, got in Lewis Hamilton's car?
And that was amazing.
But he was amazing, and I don't think anybody really expected him to be as good as he was. And he very nearly won that race in Lewis Hamilton's car, which just goes to show how good all those drivers actually are, because I think it's very easy to watch those races over the weekend and go, Lewis is the best. Lewis is this. Lewis is. And don't get me wrong, he absolutely is. He's an incredible driver, but he's also got the best car. which was very apparent when George Russell climbed in.
Yeah, like we've watched George all season, the Williams, like finishing back of the pack, like 15th was kind of a good finishing place. And then suddenly rocks up in a Mercedes and he's hammering past Bottas on the outside into a chicane. And you're just like, wow, this is amazing Formula One that we want to see.
Yeah. And so like, and to kind of drag that back to snowboarding in a way is that actually any of those 20 guys in the final or 10 guys in a final on their day are amazing. The top five will always be top five. And those top five, again, on their day, like any of them can win. And so like that, and that's because they all have to do the same things to get the same points. Does that make sense? So they end up, it's really hard for a judge. It is really hard. And I think you got the hardest job.
I was going to say, if you catch your mind back to Pyeongchang Big Air, when we had Billy's bronze, like everyone in that final, you could have had a podium.
Yeah.
Like whichever three riders you picked randomly out of those 10 would have easily been like a world-class podium. Cause I think just the standard of riding's that high and the tricks are that high nowadays. Yeah. That it's just whoever can land on the day.
Yeah.
And Tim, you got to be on there on the day. What was it like actually there? Cause we did it from London, which was me and Ian had a right blast in the commentary box to ourselves at 4 a.m. But what was it like out in South Korea and Sochi, to be fair with Jenny, when you got British medals?
Oh man. You know, it's just the pinnacle, isn't it? It's not just the pinnacle. It's going to the Olympics. I think for me, I'd always seen the Olympics as being the pinnacle of sport. And I wasn't one of these people that got sucked up in the snowboarding and skiing. It's not for the Olympics and all that rubbish. I was just like, well, if it goes, brilliant, you know. And when I got the call to go, I was just absolutely blown away. Like I was really like, couldn't believe they'd asked me to go and do it. And just found myself out in Sochi doing it. It was a bit of a dream come true, really, to work for the BBC, you know, having been a snowboarder. And I use, you know, I'm doing for people listening on the podcast, fingers over the head, professional. My mom and dad, you know, because being a professional back then, I didn't earn any money. I didn't earn money to buy a house or a car. I earned enough money to go on a few trips and I used to get free snowboards. And that was me being a professional. So my mom and dad didn't see it as a career. You know, they thought, well, he's having a nice time and that's fine. But when I started to do TV bits and work on the TV, they were like, oh, wow, okay, this is quite good. And when I finally could turn around to them and say, you know, because my dad would say, oh, you on TV? And I'm like, yeah, I'm on a program called Free Sports on 4. My dad was like, wow, when's that on? I was like, it's on at 3 o'clock in the morning on Sunday. My dad's like, that's not TV, you idiot. And so I ended up, when I could finally turn around and say to my mom and dad, I've been asked to commentate for the BBC at the Olympics. My mom and dad, I mean, my gran has got the cutouts from the newspaper and stuff. And so it was one of those moments where I was like, wow, I kind of feel like I've made it. I feel like finally something, not something to be proud of, but something I could certainly, you know, my mom and dad were proud of, I suppose I should say. And just to be there was incredible. But then to top it all off, to have one of your mates win a medal there was just mind blowing. It was absolutely mind blowing, really. And I think, you know, we got 300 official Ofcom complaints, which was I'm quite proud of. But we kind of just lost all.
Wait, which Olympics was that?
It was at Sochi. So me and
Ed, was that the Amy Fuller one?
Yeah. So Amy Fuller joined us in the commentary booth, and you know, she.
Yeah, I remember that one.
We couldn't really wrangle her, the law unto herself, really, at that one. So we just did it how we would do it. We didn't try to get it. I was basically in my head. I was back at High Wycombe in 1997, and I was screaming at Duncan Carr and Joe Rackley and Gendel and Hamish McKnight, all the snowboarders from back in the day. I was screaming at them again. And that's how we did it. And I just wanted to, me and Ed were just making each other laugh. It's worth noting as well that me and Ed had been up in that commentary booth since 7 a.m. And Gaz will know this. You get there early to watch practice because you want to see what everybody's doing and you want to see how the course is running and go down to the bottom, wait around at the bottom of the lift and just chat to a few of the riders, find out how the jumps are running and all that kind of stuff. So you get up there early and then you're in the commentary booth and you're chatting away and you've got your mic turned on and blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden in your ears, it goes in your headphones, it's like patching in. It's like, it's Vicky in Salford. Commentators in Sochi, please pause. So you just shut up and you like waiting. Then all of a sudden you hear Claire Balding in your ears going, welcome, Sunday morning. Jenny Jones has made it through to the finals and we can catch up with Tim and Ed now in Rosacuta Snowwood Park. Hi, guys. And Ed's like, hi, Claire. and I'm there going, oh my God, we're live on telly. We're live because we've been chatting away, but at this point we weren't live on telly. But now we're live on telly. And then my phone just starts going vibrating across the desk because everyone's like, holy crap, you're on telly. And it was just mental. And I think, yeah, me and Ed just commentated and we just had a laugh and we tried to make each other laugh. And the whole thing was topped off. I mean, it was a bit of a perfect storm because back in the UK, it was, of course, 7 a.m. or 8 a.m. It was a grey, horrible Sunday. So everybody was just waking up. They were all had their cups of coffee in bed watching Jenny Jones win a bronze medal. And I think a lot of people were watching it, and it went on BBC Two, which of course everybody has. And, you know, it wasn't stashed away on the red button or, so it was, it was a bit of a perfect storm for it really. But yeah, just, it's one of those once in a lifetime opportunity moments really to be able to commentate on your friend winning a bronze medal. Pretty ridiculous.
And did you feel the pressure then going into Pyeongchang? Because you'd already done it once and kind of got the hype out of the way of like being at the Olympics. Like, were you like cool, calm and collective going into South Korea? Or was it like more pressure?
Way more pressure. Yeah, because it was, we arrived there. Yeah, we arrived there and it was all of a sudden people like the production, like maybe like the sound engineers at the BBC, they were like, oh, here we go. The crazy snowboard commentators. Are you going to be funny this year? Are you going to be funny? You guys were hilarious. Please make me laugh. And I was a bit like, oh, I don't know. I'll just commentate. I don't know. I'll just see. And it was that, you know, you felt that pressure to, and me and Ed actually were a bit conscious of it at the start. And we were like, right, we just got to be, just play it safe. But I think, again, it was quite nice having that time difference that all the UK was asleep. So you were commentating knowing that everybody else was actually asleep and they'd watch it in a highlights reel, really. There wouldn't be many people.
You know, but live wasn't real live and yeah.
So it was, but it was, there's definitely more pressure. But then, I think as the Brits started to kind of fall away and make mistakes and you kind of, the pressure goes a little bit then because you all of a sudden like, oh, well, there we go. That's there. We're not going to be on any prime time. We'd want Jamie Nichols.
I just want to ask, when you're at the Olympics, is it just you and Ed Lee sort of in your own sort of bubble discussing these sort of runs, or is it, do you get to mingle, you know?
Yeah, you can.
Because there's a lot of other GB people out there, and or do you have to stay secluded?
No, it's
you're very COVID based at the moment.
I mean I'm in a COVID mindset and like I don't even know if I can cough on you, but
I'm glad that you're behind the screen. No, I'm joking.
Wait.
John, it's really funny you say that because I've this is, do you want some exclusive news now?
Come on. Come on, hit me with the exclusive.
A bit of a knobhead saying this. I'm going to be doing the Summer Olympics for the BBC. Just had an email today. So, thank you. Yeah. So BMX and skating. Yeah, no, that'd be good. But anyway, sorry to go back to you're out on the ground, you're there. And actually that was part of this email today. We're going to Tokyo, to be on the ground there because as a commentator and Gaz will know this, it's invaluable to just chat to the judge, just say a quick something. Oh, you know, how's everyone feeling? What are your thoughts? What are you looking for? Because they'll just give you that one line, which helps you as a commentator go, actually, I know what you're seeing. Because they're hard sports to understand, aren't they? I mean, they're nerdy, really. And so if you as a commentator can help to get that across, just what the judges are actually looking for and what they're seeing. and then it really helps. And also that, as you know, the riders, how are the jumps running? How are the jumps? Are they any good? Have they been shaped badly? Is the pipe good? Is there a kink in the pipe that we can't see? Is the wind, is that... So being on the ground as a commentator, you need to be there to have those ins and out, those, you know, these little insights that you can help portray in the commentary with the stories. And so, yeah, it's hard. And again, Gaz will tell you, to be in Feltham in England, it's difficult to do it from there. It's, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning.
We completely changed our entire body schedule to be like 11 p.m. to like 6 a.m.
So the Havana Club is going in. We're on the Havana Club Especial. I'm going for one more Jimmy's Coffee Cola. I genuinely hope this doesn't have coffee in it, because it is fast approaching. Oh, for crying out loud. It's fast approaching 11 o'clock. It does. It's got coffee in it. It'll be bloody wild.
It'll be buzzing until 4 in the morning.
Oh, man. Oh, well. Cheers, everybody.
Cheers.
Is Gendel like a school friend? Because we've done a Google search and stuff and things like that, and I found different things. But Gendel's been there for like more or less everything that you've been doing. Like I think the earliest stuff back in like 2010. Just like
start at the very start. I started skiing, loved it. Went away on the school ski trip. My mom and dad literally had to give up Christmas and everything to pay, because obviously, you know, not many kids back then went on school ski trips in 1992 or 93. And then when I came back, my mom found in the newspaper a coupon. Look at this, Tim, you can go skiing indoors. I was like, what? £5 to go skiing indoors at the brand new snow dome. And I was like, wow, where's that? And she was like, it's in Tamworth. It's not far. So it's only lived 7 miles. Well, I still do live 7 miles from Tamworth. And so we had a drive over after school one evening, and I went to the snow dome. It'd been open 2 weeks, and it was ski for a fiver. And I went and skied indoors in the brand new snow dome. And there was literally nobody there. It was empty. And at the end of my first time skiing, because I just loved skiing so much, at the end of it, as I was walking out past the desk, I don't know what popped into my head. I just, something like possessed me, and I just turned and I walked over to the desk, and I said to the girl behind the desk, I said, do you do school work experience here? And she said, I don't know. So she checked with the manager, a guy called Dave, and Dave came, and Dave, I can't remember his surname now, because it was about 400 years ago. Dave said, yeah, well, we haven't got anyone. You know, we've only been open 2 weeks, but yeah, we'll do work experience. So I did my 2 weeks school work experience at the Snow Dome. And from there, I then got a job, and I worked there and rode there every single day, every single hour that God sent. And I met Gendel there when I was working. Gendel, same deal. He found a coupon in the newspaper, and he came down to ride, and we just learned to snowboard together. And it was more like kind of Iceman and Maverick from Top Gun. I was Iceman and he was Maverick, and he came down and wanted to be as good as me. And that was about it, really. And the rest is history. And we just became best mates. He's a couple of years younger than me. He was 2 years younger than me. So I was 15 and he was only 13. And we just became mates. And that was the start of it, really. Man. We've been friends ever since.
You mentioned in a lot of that you went there skiing.
Yeah.
But then obviously you switched to snowboarding. How did that transition come about?
Very easily. So like day one of my work experience that down there, I was giving out all the skis. And at the end, you know, whatever, I can't remember, what was 400 pairs of hire skis. And at the very end, there were rental snowboards. And there were about five of them, or six maybe. There were Sims all mountain twin tips. They were amazing. And I remember looking at that going, whoa, that's a snowboard. I've seen that. And at the time I was a very bad skateboarder, and I used to love skateboarding. And I was like, that's how I get good at skateboarding, because it's strapped to my feet. So I went, and at the end of my very first day work experience, I had a snowboard lesson. And I just, I mean, sounds like a big-headed knobhead, but I could just do it. I could. I had one lesson at the end. I was riding from the top and jumping and doing all, and I just clicked and I could just do it and I just loved it. And then I never skied again since then, really. So yeah, I think it was a shortcut to doing all the tricks I ever wanted to do on a skateboard. I could do them instantly on a snowboard because it was easier.
Yeah, that's the frustrating thing about skateboarding. Like, the board just disappears from time to time. Whereas snowboarding, that happens, you've gone really badly wrong.
Yeah, so it's gone really badly wrong. I've had it in my time. I've ejected from both bindings once. I've ejected from both bindings and snapped both the bindings off with a good slam as well twice. But yeah, it is. It was the shortcut, wasn't it, to being able to do all the grabs and all that kind of stuff. But actually, I have learnt to ski again since, and I'm still a very bad skier. But I enjoy that as much now. It's good fun to go and challenge yourself doing that, isn't it?
Fair enough. I mean, you say that it's quite rare for the snowboard to disappear under you, but the first time I went snowboarding, I went to a resort in Switzerland, and it was a resort, I think it was called Garmisch, and it had a really long blue run all from the very top down to the bottom of the resort. And I think I got one turn in and the instructor was like, oh, we'll stop here for a break. And I was skiing. I'd already been skiing a few years at this point, but I was fed up with snowboarding. I took off my board, I put it on the side, and it just slid.
I thought you were saying, put my snowboard down, turned around, looked back, and it had gone.
It just went. I was so pissed off. Like, I was already so annoyed because I've been falling over at every other point to this, like, down this little run. It's like a little cat track, more or less. Like, I was fuming that he took us down there, you know?
Yeah.
And it ended up in the middle of a frozen reservoir.
Oh,
and
no.
Someone had to go out with snowshoes and go and fetch it, and I basically just slid out the rest on my butt. And yeah, I was at that point, I was, you know, all right. And then someone else in my group broke their wrist going down. Another beginner snowboarder broke their wrist going down, and the instructor gave him like a piggyback on the way down, and he showed me no compassion before that.
Yeah.
No, like, he was happy just letting me slide down on my ass the whole way.
Mate, you need to break. You needed to have broken a wrist.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Well, I actually did. I learned to snowboard obviously indoors, so I never learned on dry slope, and I became quite proficient, you know, with my turns, and it was fine. And then I went straight to dry slope, and first swaddling coat just up the road. First turn, broke my thumb. Started off right, heel, bang, down, snap, thumb, gone. That was it. Didn't ride dry slope for ages after that. And then I think, next time I went, I broke my other thumb. So, yeah, I kind of had the right passage, but it wasn't my wrists. It was more of just both my thumbs on Dendex.
Dude, I wouldn't feel bad. I mean, I've been skiing for years and years, and I think it was about 10 years before I actually hit a dry slope when skiing.
Really?
And The very first run.
You're a product of the snowboard as well.
No, I grew up in Germany.
Oh, okay.
So actual mountains for me. But yeah, but first time I hit a dry slope, I broke my thumb.
Oh, man.
And I've been skiing for years and years and years. So I think it's just a dry slope thing. You know?
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever done my thumb on dry slope. I've only done wrists and fingers. Thumbs have always stayed nicely tucked in.
It's Dendex. It's Dendex. It's those diagonals.
Yeah, those cubes of the diamonds of doom. I ripped my bum hole open. My brother broke his wrist in Dendex really badly, actually, to the point where he still can't bend his wrist. They kind of almost fused it, his scaphoids. That was it. High Wycombe Dry Slope Champs in 1997. He did that. And
Tim, can you rewind to your bum hole?
Yeah, rip my bum hole open. And actually, I laughed at the guys that used to stick the camping mats, bits of camping mats down the backs of their jeans. What's his face used to do it, didn't he? God, I can't think of his name. I've got terrible memory from Hillingdon. He's the guy that used to ride the clickers, the step-ins. You'll have all the old school dry slopers screaming at their podcast right now. Rob, might have to text Joe Rackley and ask him. He'll know. Anyway, he used to ride with camping mat down the inside of his jeans. And we used to mock him and be like, why are you doing that? He was like, not going to hurt my bum again. And then, yeah, I think it was one of the slalom contests, and I was going as fast as I could and hit again, caught my heel edge, went down, and literally, I think my bum cheeks were about a foot apart. It was insane how painful that was. Felt like I literally got down to the T-bar at the bottom when no one was looking. I put my hand in my pants to check there was no blood. I was convinced that I'd like ripped my bum hole open. But yeah, you only do it once, don't you? It's a very quick learning curve, dry slope. You never break your thumb again. You don't put your hand down, you go to your elbow.
I haven't done it after that first time.
Yeah, it's you only do it once.
I'll be flying back to Birmingham quite regularly as well, so I'm always there.
Man, we should definitely go for a shred and have a rum and cola afterwards or something. That'd be wicked.
Oh, 100%.
It's been definitely. Quite nice living back. So I've been back in Birmingham for about like 6 years ago or something now, and it's quite nice. I still go to the Snow Dome. You know, I don't go as regularly as I like. That's because I've got kids and they're idiots and they ruin your life. But when I do get to go to the Snow Dome, it's I really enjoy it. I probably go once every 2 or 3 months for a couple of runs, and I love it.
It's always Tamworth,
yeah.
It's, do you still ever hit that sketchy quarter pipe at the end?
Every time. It's my thing. I mean, I don't get air. It's more for just to kind of go my board around and bring me back the other way, to be honest. But it was the holy grail, wasn't it, at a time, a quarter pipe, an indoor quarter pipe. You know, loads of people had to go at them, but it's just keeping the snow and keeping it working, and it's a lot of maintenance, but yeah.
It's definitely like a big pull factor of Tamworth, I think. I mean, when you see people here now, because they don't often have, I mean, I like Tamworth as a center. There's so many different turns, but they don't often have like a big kicker.
Yeah.
It's always like a little lip or something. But the fact that they've always got that quarter pipe and then obviously the balcony, like the big balcony to do the viewings from.
Yeah.
I feel like they've got their own different unique little things that they can bring people in with it. If they got rid of those, it'd be crazy.
It's also so underrated. The corner, man. It's got a corner. Not me. Nowhere else has got a corner. It's got a turn.
Yeah.
You know.
You only have a turn one way.
That's actually very true, man. Like all other snow domes, like every other snow dome in the UK is just straight.
Yeah.
That one's got a turn.
Got a turn, man. 90 degrees. You are halfway to going back on yourself. That's too much rum. You don't make sense.
That's our title for the podcast now.
Halfway to going back on yourself.
So where do you see snowboarding going next? Which I've realized isn't that quick fire a question, because that's probably 7 days worth of philosophical discussions.
So this isn't mine. This isn't my idea, but this has resonated for me massively, because certainly from the era that I'm from, this is what it was all about. This is actually Ed Lee's idea, and it's basically to take snowboarding back to where it kind of was in the late 90s, early 2000s, which is where snowboarders once again become all-rounders. Now, I do appreciate that snowboarding is in such a place where you can't be top of pipe and top of slope and a big mountain rider, because they're just so gnarly in their own right. But I do think there is place to start creating an all-round snowboarder again. And the World Surf League do it very well, where they surf different waves, but those same 20 surfers go on this tour. And Ed Lee's, I'm not sure how top secret this is. I mean, it's not anymore, I'm telling you boys, but I think Ed's trying to start a World Series that does the Mount Bachelor Bank Slalom. It does the Lax Open pipe, it does the US Open slope style, it does a Helsinki rail session, and it ends up in Alaska with a big mountain free ride contest. So it's 5 stops all around the globe, all different events with 20 invited riders, and then you get wild cards, and then you get people that drop in and out, and it's to create and bring back all-round snowboarders. You've got people that dabble, you know, you've got Travis Rice's, Gigi Ruffs, you've got Haldor. I mean, you could go on. Mark McMorris. You give Mark McMorris a day and a half pipe, he'll be absolutely shredding without a doubt. So these riders that can do all these things. And once again, you tune in and you'd watch these 20 guys tackle, and it would breed a new style of snowboarder. And don't get me wrong, I'm totally not against jibbing. I'm totally not against hardcore pipe dudes or border crossers or anything like that. I love it. And I love the fact that snowboarding has gone in those ways and is actually so amazing in all those genres. And I think there's a place for all the genres, but I would love to see snowboarding and certainly skiing as well. Definitely freestyle skiing and getting back to having those all-round riders, someone that you can look at and go, you are the best snowboarder in the world. You are the best freestyle skier in the world.
That'd be an amazing idea, but I think you need a sixth stop with like a dry slope session somewhere.
Me too.
Just get the 20 best of a Halifax and be like, how good really are you?
Yeah.
Because that would separate the men from the boys pretty easily.
Can you imagine? It was like I don't know if you remember way back in the day, Terrier Harkinson came to Sheffield half pipe dry slope. That was good.
Yeah. I like to drop that in with like a couple of my Canadian friends are talking about like half pipe. It's like, oh, we used to have a half pipe in the UK. It was dry slope. And they're like, how do you edge and turn up that? And we're like, yeah, you
very
just
got it with hope. Great difficulty. Yeah.
So on to our next quickfire question. Go. Who would be invited to your ultimate snowboarding dinner party?
Ooh.
Do they have some of the chance for you to get your bow tie out as well?
Yeah.
Oh no, we'll go nuts. Anyone.
Okay, but if it's a snowboard dinner party, there's gonna be snowboarders there, I guess. Jamie.
You have Gendel being the butler in the buff.
Gendel's the butler in the buff. I'd have Jamie Lynn there for one of the most stylish. I'd have Tom Burt there, old free ride legend, Tom Burt. Gigi Ruff. I'd have Stale Sandbeck, so I could just look into his eyes all night. He's so dreamy. And then probably Red Gerrard, because he's, how many is that? How many am I allowed? Because he's just a nutcase, that kid.
Oh. It's a huge room. It goes on for ages.
All right.
It's not COVID restrictions. You can have more than six.
And I'd bring in Michael Jordan. He'd be good fun. I think Bill Nighy would be a good crack. We'd have after dinner speech by Sir David Attenborough. He could tell us some cool stuff. Probably have Obama there and Michelle.
Yeah.
Love Michelle. Yeah. I'd have Beyonce sing afterwards. Can I bring anyone back from the dead?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
All right. Then I'd have and in that case I'd have Nirvana. I'd bring Kurt Cobain back.
Oh, that would be good.
Yeah.
Have a little Beyonce for the stars, then Nirvana for the main course.
Yeah.
Whoa. That would be that. I'd attend that dinner party. I'd pay good money to be there.
Mate, what a sesh that would be. But if we had to be a bit more realistic about it, I'd probably get the entire cast of the 2000 British snowboard champs in Meyerhofen back together, because that was a riot that weekend. Oh my God, that week.
So what's the most inappropriate time that you've been drunk or hungover?
Ooh, I mean, I've been drunk quite a lot. The quickest one that springs to mind when I've got, I mean, I've been inappropriate loads. So actually to cut through there is going to be hard. I got really drunk the night before Gendel's wedding last year. So I was best man at Gendel's wedding. We went to his wedding and they had a really nice thing where everybody played golf the day before. So they had this big golf day. When his dad or father-in-law organized this thing where everybody kicked off a game of golf on their respective tees, like with a big, it's like a little, so like 18 holes, everybody starts and everybody goes around the golf course. And it was amazing. Teams of 8, and it was just a really, really nice, fun round of golf. And everybody, but of course, I had a bottle of tequila in my bag, and I finished a bottle of tequila with the help of other people having but this was the day before the wedding, and it was when Storm Katrin or something came in, and Storm Caroline, and so
Katrina.
Storm Katrina, thank you, came in, and their whole wedding venue changed. So they moved the whole wedding venue from a completely different place down to where we were. So they built the tent that night, the day before the wedding, and it was all hands on deck to get everything up and done. And but of course I was just in the bar, and they couldn't get me away from the bar to help or anything. So I took full best man duties and just got the drunkest out of everybody. And I didn't think that wasn't too bad, but I was certainly loud and buying drinks and throwing drinks around. But the next day, Gendel, as we were kind of getting ready, he was like, we set up the tent. Don't worry about that. Kind of made me feel a bit bad, but someone had to get the drunkest. So there's always going to be the drunkest person. And that night was me.
Don't you worry about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a very fair, very fair accolade to have.
Yeah. So it's, that was pretty bad, I suppose, but I mean, we've all been hungover and been in those situations. I mean, one of the worst times I've ever been hungover, I was on all fours on my hands and knees being sick in the disabled toilets in Starbucks at the Fort Shopping Centre midway through changing my daughter's nappy. So I'm changing my daughter's nappy on the floor of the disabled toilets, and I was having to pause to be sick in the toilet. I was like, don't look at daddy. Don't look at me.
So Tim, who's the most famous person you've been hammered with? This one's from Ian Finlay from the Eurosport box.
Hello, Ian Finlay.
Actually, this is a very, very good question.
Who's the most famous person I've been hammered with? I mean, Ed Lee, you could say, is famous. I've been hammered with him loads. Ed Lee, obviously, Ski Sunday presenter. I've been hammered with Graham Bell, and he's a Ski Sunday presenter. They're both pretty loose, them boys, when they want to let go. Name drop clang, here it comes. I went to the England versus Sweden World Cup game with Martin Corrie, who was then the England rugby captain, or is it ex-England? But everyone recognised him. I mean, he was doing photos, everyone's saying, but we got pretty hammered together. That was pretty good. I got pretty hammered with Danny McCaskill. I mean, he's quite famous in the bike world, isn't he?
Who's the most ridiculous that you've seen on Famous First Words?
Who's the most ridiculous? What, as in
good? Oh, yeah.
As in good singer?
And we both know that you've seen some weird stuff on Famous First Words. So don't even try and pretend that
let's just put it all into context. Famous First Words. So Famous First Words is a party night that me and my best mate Gendel came up with, and it's a quizzical musical game show. Me and Gendel will play the start of a song, and if anybody in the crowd thinks that they can sing along to the first line of the song, then they scream, whoop, holler, whatever they want. We then get them up on stage, we restart the song, and they have to sing along to the famous first words. And it's become a bit of a game show. It started off with me and Gendel battling each other off our laptops, and it's now turned into a game show that we play. It's like a club and a pub night that we do. And it's kind of it's a bit of a business that me and Gendel have going on, a party night. And we've done two Edinburgh Fringe festivals, and we do corporate gigs and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, we do a London night, and we've done loads, and we've been doing it for over 4 years. But yeah, random stuff. I mean, we've seen it all. We've seen guys get carried off the stage for being so amazing. I've seen workmen come up and sing songs better than Sam Smith. I've seen girls flash their boobies. Gendel and his wife Camilla met on stage. She came up to sing, and Gendel was like, what's your name, where are you from? She said, I'm Camilla from Nottingham. 3 years later, they're married. I mean, that's a great story in itself.
All right, fair enough.
We've had
that's a love story.
Yeah,
We've had, I don't know if you remember, in the day from Nuts magazine, there was a girl called Lucy Pinder. She came.
Yeah.
She just appeared on
stage. I mean, who?
Yeah. So that was pretty nuts. Like, oh, God, you're Lucy Pinder. I remember you from Nuts magazine. And then, yeah. And then Elise Christie, you know, the ice skater, she's popped up on stage. Yes, yes. So yeah, a few. And then, but I think one of the weirdest nights was when, I don't know if you just saw a few weeks ago in Nazaré in Portugal, there was a huge, big swell come through. And one of the world's big wave surfers, a guy called Andrew Cotton, was surfing a huge wave. He's a North Devon surfer. Now we know him through our time on Red Bull. And I remember him just like pushing his way through the crowd to come up on stage and just jumped up on stage and he was shirtless. He was hammered, but shirtless. And I was like, oh, hey, you're all right. He's like, just press play. I'll sing this. I'm like, no, we should sit down. We should sit down. So that was pretty ridiculous. So yeah, we've seen some ridiculous things for sure. Oh, we've nearly had fights. Had to split up a fight the once and like stop the whole night because this guy was just being an idiot. And
so, because it's a Friday night, Tim, and well, it's pretty late. We're getting some shots in. Oh, you're going to get some shots in because you're the guest. What shots are you going to buy?
It's tequila. It's easy, that. That's an easy one.
Oh, my God.
Tequila.
Oh, look, Tim.
Without the salt and lemon, just straight in tequila. Job done.
Okay.
Straight up.
Okay.
I mean, if you've got any tequila,
do you ever like
have one now?
I keep thinking to buy a bottle of tequila just to have in the flat, but I think it's a very dangerous thing.
Very dangerous.
Just for, yeah. Because I always used to do the thing when you go up to the bar and like everyone's like, oh yeah, I'll have another beer. So you go up and get like three beers and then you like sneak in three tequilas as well and you bring them all back. And it's like, hey, surprise.
Surprise.
I went through a period of when I had a bit of time off drinking beer and I felt great for it, to be honest. I lost some weight and I just did feel really good. And then I started getting back into drinking because it's dead good. Although I don't advocate underage drinking or binge drinking, just so we're fully aware.
Yeah, no.
But yeah, I got back into drinking and for some reason I got back into drinking a shot of tequila and then a pint of water and then another shot of tequila and a pint of water. And you would fly through the nights. It was like, I think it was, I do you know what? You might struggle to believe this. I've never done drugs at all. And it's the closest I think what it'd be like to doing drugs because it was a drunk that I just couldn't describe. It was amazing because you had loads of energy, but like when you look left and right, like you had coordination of your body, but when you look left and right, like your eyes took a couple of seconds to follow. I don't know. I don't know why I've got into it. Oh, I tell you why. Because I got back into drinking for my wedding. And after my wedding, we went to Mexico for a honeymoon, me and my wife. And we did some tequila sampling and tequila drinking. And the guy that was teaching us or was like talking us through the tequilas was like, oh, this is this one and this is this. And you drink this one with a bit of water on the side and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, and that was the one I liked the most. So when I got back, I was like, yeah, okay, everyone, yeah. Just so you know, you drink tequila and water, like pretending I knew everything. Totally. And so I was just having 30 shots of tequila with a pint of water. But yeah, it was good.
Who would you recommend for the podcast? Who would you like to see as a guest?
Do they have to drink as much as I've drank? Because there's not many people.
I mean, really, they don't. But at the same time, if you want them to...
Gendel, obviously. For someone I'd like to see their guard slip and have a good chat with, Woodsy. Woodsy's got some story. I don't know how much boozing he does or did back in the day, but yeah.
But Tim, it's been a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Where can we find you in the digital world nowadays?
Oh, geez. Oh, God, panic. Drank too much. Well... I'm Tim Warwood. Find me on Famous Birthdays, age 47, earning £1.3 million. Actor, IMDb.
Yeah. Wherever you want to find me, I'll be there. No, I've started my own podcast as well. I mean, you know, it's what do you call, what's the pronoun for two white guys? It's a podcast, isn't it? It's so yeah, me and Gendel have started a podcast, and I do the Tim and Gen Weekend Podcast. Shameless plug. There it is. Clunk.
Nice.
One hell of an episode we had with Tim just there. We are so thankful you could come on to share some of those stories with us, and damn, the rums were flowing hard. If you heard me fall off my chair at some point there, I am sure you are mistaken. Anyway, right now, as always, we have got a rum, and if you could show us some love on social media, Instagram and Twitter is at Rum and Stoke. But we love it when you guys get in touch via email. It is rumandstokepodcast@gmail.com. And next week, we have an awesome guest lined up. We are talking to Olympian and GB rider TJ Harding. Big up yourselves and catch you next week.